The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and perhaps the Harvard Heart Letter. The first article comes from the January 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, who is the editor-in-chief. The issue is, does your gut affect your risk for Alzheimer's disease? Question. I know your genes and lifestyle can influence your risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. Now I read that microbes in our guts also may be involved. Really? And Dr. Komaroff responds, genes and lifestyle both influence our risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. And as strange as it may seem, so may the microbes in our gut. We've known for 200 years that microbes live on and in us. We thought they were just living off the warmth and nutrients that our body provided to them, invisible freeloaders that had no effect on our health. Beginning about 20 years ago, we began to learn that that was wrong. Like humans, microbes have genes. All of the different genes of the microbes that live on us or in us collectively are called our microbiome. To our surprise, we've learned that these microbe genes can make chemicals that affect human health. We now know that our microbiome can affect our risk for obesity, diabetes, atherosclerosis, and other important diseases. A study reported in October 2023 in the prestigious scientific journal Brain finds that our microbiome may even influence our risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Previous studies had reported that in people with Alzheimer's disease, some particular species of gut bacteria are more prevalent, while other species are less so compared to people without the disease. But that did not answer the cart and horse question. Does the disease affect the difference in the gut bacteria, or does the difference in the gut bacteria affect the disease? The new study provides provocative evidence that the gut bacteria may actually influence the risk of getting the disease. The research team took a group of healthy young rats and eliminated all bacteria from their guts. Then the team collected bowel movements from people with Alzheimer's disease and from people with normal cognition and no signs of the disease. Such samples are full of gut bacteria. Then the samples from humans were squirted into the rats' guts. The microbiome from people with Alzheimer's disease, but not the microbiome from people without the disease, caused Alzheimer's-like changes in the rats' brains. Those rats also developed memory impairment. Moreover, the rats that received the microbiomes from the most severely affected Alzheimer's patients developed the greatest brain abnormalities and memory problems. It will require much more research to confirm that our gut microbiome influences our risk of Alzheimer's disease, and if so, how it does so. The answer to that last question could someday point to treatments that can treat or even prevent Alzheimer's disease. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter of January 2024 is called Tips to Navigate a Sleep Divorce. Sometimes happy partners choose to sleep in separate beds or even separate bedrooms. When your bed partner regularly shatters your good night's rest by snoring, kicking, tossing and turning, or stealing the covers, for example, you might wonder if you'd be better off sleeping apart. And you're not alone if you give it a try. A 2023 survey by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine found that a third of respondents occasionally or regularly sleep in separate rooms to accommodate a bed partner. Keep in mind that the arrangement comes with a risk. Your relationship might suffer, especially if one person doesn't want to sleep apart or doesn't like the new sleeping environment. Dr. Stephanie Collier, a psychiatrist at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital, says, here's what you can do if you're considering a sleep divorce. Have a heart-to-heart first. Discuss your partner's disruptive sleep behaviors with compassion and talk about the problems that result for both of you. The conversation can be embarrassing. It requires you to be vulnerable, and a lot of sensitive topics might come up beyond sleep behavior. If it's hard to communicate about it, consider couples counseling with an objective third party to guide you. Seek a compromise. Before seeking a complete sleep divorce, consider compromises acceptable to both of you. If your partner's snoring wakes you up, try wearing earplugs. Use a bedside sound machine or wear earbuds and listen to a podcast as you fall asleep. If snoring is a problem, your partner could try sleeping on his or her side and seeing a doctor to find out what's causing the snoring. Dr. Collier recommends you go together to the doctor's appointment so you both learn about any possible underlying conditions and treatments, like continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, for sleep apnea. Another solution could be sleeping separately in the same room. Perhaps you each get a bed. That's helpful when one person awakens frequently to urinate or has involuntary twitching movements in the legs during sleep. Another idea is napping in the same place during the day, but sleeping apart at night. If you decide to try sleeping apart, consider following these ideas. Make both sleeping spaces cozy. Neither of you should have to sleep on the couch. You both need a good mattress and a comfortable sleeping environment that's cool, dark, and inviting. Schedule intimacy. Sharing a bed promotes personal connection, sexual activity, and feelings of comfort and security. To get the same intimacy when you sleep apart, Dr. Collier says you must make a concerted effort. For example, if nighttime is when you have sex, cuddle, or share meaningful details of your day, schedule that before bedtime, then move to separate rooms after your time together. Or set aside time for closeness during the day and make it a priority. It can be tough sleeping alone after years of being together, especially if you have anxiety or stress. You'll have to develop your own bedtime routine, one that makes you feel relaxed and sleepy, like reading for a little while and then turning out the light and listening to a bedside sound machine. If you miss the comfort and security of your partner, sleeping with a body pillow or weighted blanket might help. Or talk to your partner on the phone or in a video call as you're going to sleep. That way you can still be together. Check in with each other daily to see what's working and what isn't. It's not good enough if it's helpful only for one person. Go back to the drawing board and come up with something better. Your relationship is at stake, and so is your health and well-being. Sleeping apart can be beneficial if both parties are happy with the setup, both parties sleep well, and you continue to nurture your relationship. There's a small additional article that says, why consider a sleep divorce? Sleeping apart seems counterintuitive for couples, but a good night's sleep is very important for health. Sleep deprivation promotes depression, anxiety, and difficulty concentrating, which can keep you from engaging well with your partner. A lack of sleep also increases the risk of chronic health conditions like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cognitive decline, says Dr. Stephanie Collier, a psychiatrist at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. The goal is to sleep 7 to 9 hours per night. Work with your partner to make sleep a priority for both of you, and make that sleep top quality. Now, here's a useful article. It's entitled, Should You Order Your Own Alzheimer's Test? You don't need your doctor's okay to get a new screening, but some experts say it's not ready for prime time. The idea of getting Alzheimer's disease is troubling for everyone, and if you have a family history of the condition or if you've been experiencing persistent memory loss, you might wonder if it's time to seek testing. Traditionally, the process starts with a doctor visit and evaluation. You can now order an Alzheimer's blood screening on your own. The question is, should you? The screening is called AD-DETECT. That's capital A, capital D, dash, DETECT. It's available through Quest Diagnostics for $399 plus a $13 fee for physician services. Anyone 18 or older can go online and order AD-DIRECT. I'm sorry, it's actually called AD-DETECT, D-E-T-E-C-T, without a doctor visit. And a Quest-affiliated doctor will review the order to determine if it's medically necessary. Eligibility is based on risk factors like a family history of Alzheimer's, a decline in thinking skills, previous head trauma or brain injury, or excessive alcohol use. If the test is prescribed, you go to the nearest Quest lab to have your blood drawn. Quest analyzes the sample, looking for two types of proteins, amyloid beta 40, which is naturally present in the brain and considered normal, and amyloid beta 42, which is involved in forming Alzheimer's brain plaques. To see your result, a comparison of the protein level, you log on at your Quest portal. You can also chat with a Quest-affiliated doctor about your results and the next steps. Ordering the new Alzheimer's screening comes with risks. First of all, it's not FDA approved. The screening doesn't need the FDA's okay to be marketed to consumers. Secondly, it's only a screening test. A positive result means that your risk of getting Alzheimer's is increased, but it does not mean that you definitely have Alzheimer's. Also, we don't know how accurate it is. Very little information about AD-DETECT is available to the public. No peer-reviewed research on the screening has been published, so we don't know the risk of false results. A false negative result, one that says your risk is low or normal when in fact it's increased, might give you a false sense of security and cause you to delay pursuing diagnosis and treatment, even if you're having symptoms. A false positive result, one that says your risk is increased when in fact it's normal, might cause you undue stress and anxiety, plus time and expense in seeking further testing. There are few diagnoses I can think of that would be worse to hear. It might cause anxiety, depression, even an alteration of life plans for the entire family, says Dr. Andrew Budson, a lecturer in neurology at Harvard Medical School and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. There is also a delay to speak with the doctor. It can take a few days to speak with a Quest-affiliated doctor about your results, which might be stressful. Also, you might need further testing. If the results suggest you need additional testing, you'll have to turn to a specialist. Would you have access to a neurologist who specializes in Alzheimer's care and facilities offering tests you might need? Would it be hard to get an appointment to discuss your next steps? The wait to see dementia specialists can be 6 months or more. An Alzheimer's diagnosis requires much more than blood screening. It involves a comprehensive evaluation of your current and past health problems, physical and neurologic exams, family history, blood tests to rule out hidden conditions that might be causing memory problems, like vitamin B12 deficiency, and imaging tests. I would start with a brain MRI or a CT scan to look for structural problems, like strokes or brain tumors. If we ruled out everything and I still suspect Alzheimer's, I might also order an amyloid PET scan or a test of spinal fluid that could contain Alzheimer's markers. Doctors can also order blood tests designed to help diagnose Alzheimer's. Like the AdDetect screening, these tests look for amyloid proteins, but they go further by looking for other markers of Alzheimer's. But these tests aren't yet as accurate as spinal fluid or PET scan, Dr. Budson says. Self-ordered screening blood tests may someday have a role in investigating Alzheimer's diagnosis, but Dr. Budson thinks they're not a good idea today. If you have concerns about Alzheimer's disease, talk to your primary care doctor. Investigate your risk together. If necessary, get recommendations for an Alzheimer's specialist. This could be one of the most important decisions of your life. Approach it as carefully as possible. Now, the next article in the Harvard Health Letter concerns a rather controversial subject. It's entitled, "Is Moderate Drinking Heart Healthy?" Drinking excessive amounts of alcoholic beverages damages many organs, particularly the liver, brain, and heart. Paradoxically, however, beginning about 50 years ago, studies began to suggest that moderate drinking might actually be good for the heart. Moderate drinking is defined as one or two drinks per day for a man and one drink per day for a woman. A drink is defined as a shot of spirits, a 5-ounce glass of wine, or a 12-ounce bottle of beer. The evidence for a heart benefit from moderate drinking comes from observational research involving hundreds of thousands of people whose drinking patterns and health have been closely followed for decades. People in these investigations have been divided into roughly three groups: non-drinkers, moderate drinkers, and more than moderate drinkers. Over time, moderate drinkers have had lower rates of coronary artery disease compared to both of the other two groups. That makes sense, since other studies have found that moderate drinking causes good cholesterol to rise and blood to clot a little less easily, both of which could explain a lower rate of heart attacks, says Dr. Anthony Komaroff, an internal medicine specialist and Health Letter editor-in-chief. Based on these results, the current dietary guidelines for Americans recommends drinking only in moderation, if at all. Other authoritative organizations like the CDC and the American Heart Association have echoed this advice. However, none of these guidelines recommend moderate drinking as a way of protecting against heart disease, because observational studies cannot prove the value of a drug or a practice like moderate drinking. If an observational study finds that people who have just one drink a day are less likely to develop heart disease than people who do not drink, that does not necessarily mean that the moderate drinking pattern is the reason for the lower rate of heart disease. Maybe moderate drinkers are different in some other way, which the study did not measure, that protects them from developing heart disease. For example, suppose moderate drinkers are also more likely than non-drinkers to engage in other practices that are heart healthy, but that are not yet known to be so, and therefore are not measured by the study. Maybe it's those other practices, not the moderate drinking, that explains the lower rate of developing heart disease. Or suppose that the non-drinkers are born with a gene that gives them an unpleasant reaction when they drink alcohol, and that's why they don't drink. Suppose that same gene also raises the risk of getting heart disease. No such gene has been discovered, but it could exist. If that gene is the reason non-drinkers have more heart disease than people who take a drink a day, then people without that gene would get no heart benefit from taking a drink a day. Good observational studies do their best to take account of all factors that might affect an outcome, Dr. Komaroff says. Unfortunately, they can't be done perfectly, and they can't take account of risk factors that have not yet been discovered. The way to prove the value of any kind of treatment, including nutritional practices like moderate drinking, is to conduct randomized controlled trials. In such trials, the treatment or practice is assigned at random to some people and not to others. That way, there are two groups of people who are very similar in all respects but one. In this case, whether or not they drink in moderation. The health of both groups would be carefully monitored over time. An ideal randomized trial of moderate drinking would assign many thousands of people at random to either take one drink a day or to never drink every day for years and undergo regular checks to determine if they were actually doing what they were assigned to do. Such a study would provide strong evidence as to whether people who had one drink every day were less likely to develop heart disease than those who never drank. Some randomized trials of nutritional practices have been conducted, but it's not easy to find people willing to participate. In considering whether moderate drinking improves heart health, we're left with large observational studies. Several recent investigations have not found clear evidence that people who take a drink a day are less likely to develop heart disease than people who don't drink. This new evidence doesn't negate past studies. It simply must be weighed against past studies. And now I'd like to turn to some news briefs, again in the Harvard Health Letter of January 2024. And the first is, will eating red meat bring on diabetes? It's well established that eating red meat is linked to increased risk for colorectal cancer. And now a Harvard study published online October 19, 2023, by the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition suggests that eating red meat every week, just a little, is tied to increased diabetes risks. Researchers analyzed information for more than 216,000 men and women, average age 46 when the study began, who answered questions about their health and diet every few years, for up to 36 years. Compared with people who reported eating the least red meat every week, people who reported eating the most had a 62% higher risk of developing diabetes. For each additional daily serving of processed red meat, like a bacon or a hot dog, participants had a 46% greater risk of diabetes. The risk was 24% higher for each additional daily serving of unprocessed red meat, like pork, beef, or lamb. The good news was that swapping one daily serving of red meat for another protein like nuts or beans was tied to a much lower risk of getting diabetes. Another interesting brief article from the Harvard Health Letter of January 2024. Uncontrolled high blood pressure or diabetes is tied to severe COVID-19 outcomes. Here's another incentive for people with high blood pressure or diabetes to lower their numbers. A study of almost 1.5 million people in the United States suggests that having uncontrolled high blood pressure or diabetes prior to getting COVID-19 sharply increases the risk of COVID complications. Researchers evaluated participants' health both before and during the time they developed COVID from March 2020 to February 2022. Compared with people whose blood pressure was the best controlled before getting infected, those with the worst controlled blood pressure had about a 30% greater odds of needing hospitalization or critical care, and a 32% greater odds of being on a ventilator. Among participants with diabetes, those whose blood sugar was most poorly controlled before getting COVID had about a 61% greater odds of being hospitalized, 42% greater odds of needing critical care, 12% greater odds of being on a ventilator, and 18% greater odds of dying compared with those whose blood sugar was the best controlled. The study, published online October 18, 2023, by the Journal of the American Heart Association was observational and doesn't prove that controlling diabetes and high blood pressure protects against COVID complications. But we know for sure that controlling these conditions also reduces the risk of heart or kidney disease, as well as premature death. And that's reason enough. Finally, under news briefs, having a hobby is tied to happiness and well-being. Check those holiday gifts. If you receive one that can get you started on a new hobby, it might be the gift that keeps on giving. A study published online in Nature Medicine suggests that having a hobby is good for your health. Researchers combed through five large studies involving more than 93,000 people across 16 countries, including the United States, Japan, and China. Participants were all 65 or older, and more than 60% had long-term mental or physical health conditions. They periodically answered questionnaires about their health and well-being and were followed for 48 years. Compared with people who didn't have hobbies, those who did reported better health, more happiness, fewer symptoms of depression, and higher life satisfaction. The findings were similar across all countries. The study is observational and doesn't prove that hobbies cause people to be healthy and happy. But the researchers say hobbies like arts and crafts, games, and gardening involve creativity, sensory engagement, self-expression, relaxation, and cognitive stimulation, which are linked to good mental health and well-being. Plus, taking part in a hobby keeps you socially connected, which helps to reduce loneliness and isolation. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.